Hi, listeners. This is a quick thank you for listening and for your ongoing support. If you're enjoying the program, please consider clicking the follow or subscribe button if you haven't done so already. It really helps us out. There's no better way to support us than doing that or sharing the show with a friend, colleague, family member, or any new or expecting parent in your life. It's totally appreciated. On with the show. Hi, I'm Sarah Trott, and welcome to the Fourth Trimester Podcast. I'm a new mama, and this podcast is all about postpartum care for the first few months following birth, the time period also known as the fourth trimester. My postpartum doula, Esther Gallagher, is my co-host. She's a mother, grandmother, perinatal educator, birth and postpartum care provider. Fourth trimester care, our topic, is about the practical, emotional, and social support parents and baby require. And importantly, it helps set the tone for the continuing journey of parenting. Hi, welcome back to the Fourth Trimester Podcast. I'm Sarah Trott, and I'm here with Esther Gallagher. And we are here to record part three, the final episode of Birth Plan or Birth Intentions. So let's pick up where we left off. I think we wanted to talk a little bit about induction and then C-sections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that it's common for folks to think that if they have to have an induction or have a planned C-section, or if in the course of their labor they have a C-section, that, you know, all their preferences basically go out the window and they're going to have, you know, a terrible experience. But I want to just be the person that says out loud that that does not have to be the case. Induction can be quite natural and quite experienced the way a natural labor would be experienced, so long as your birth team are people who can really support you in having that natural childbirth. And so all the things we talked about in terms of birth preferences previously could still be the case, even if you have to show up at the hospital at 8 a.m. and go through a process that's mediated by a little more intervention. It doesn't have to be one that you can't get through without avoiding, where possible, drugs, epidural, etc. It does mean that you might want to really talk with a doula who's feels skillful around supporting people during induction and knows how to help partners understand the importance of intimacy for a mom who's going through induction and all the things we've talked about in the past. So if people can kind of take the fear out of it and grieve for that wished for, you know, going into labor, quote unquote, naturally and on their own, if they can kind of process that and for the time being set it aside and have it just be part of their birth story rather than the thing that made everything go to hell, I think people can actually have a wonderful experience with an induction so long as everything stays relatively healthy.
Mm-hmm. And if someone's induced, do they have to remain at the hospital?
Yes. Yeah. Part of the reason for that is that they want to be sure that you're responding to the medicines that they're giving you to get you into labor and then move your labor along in a healthy way, and especially your baby. So typically one of the things, and we talked about this at the end of last week's podcast, one of the things that you also have to relinquish is intermittent monitoring, because they're really going to want to be sure that your contractions are normal in strength and duration and that your baby can tolerate them. Mm-hmm. Because these medicines, you know, sometimes a woman's body will respond to them in ways that are a little kind of going overboard. But I just want to say for the record that I've been at perfectly natural childbirths where women have had labors that just their babies couldn't tolerate. You know, everybody's involved in this, and everybody needs healthcare during this process, whether it's at home or the hospital. And, you know, one of the things that they're going to be careful of on your baby's behalf is that they can actually tolerate the contractions that you are having. So while I don't like, I think we need new technology for fetal monitoring, and I think it's right around the corner, I hope, because of the discomfort to mothers. I do think that, you know, babies also need to be attended to during the course of labor. And so finding a way to do that in a healthy way. And, you know, there are some inductions that go so well that they do in intermittent monitoring. So it depends on your nurse, depends on your doctors, midwives, what they think is going to be the best route for your course of labor. So, it, you know, part of that depends on why you're being induced.
Right.
Right. So let's, from there, move on to cesarean birth. And in our preferences plan, for the person this one was written for, they've written, should cesarean birth be necessary? We would like both of us and our doula in the operating room. Please perform delivery respective of as much of our birth preferences as possible. Allow parents immediate contact with baby, if well, for as long as possible, and allow them to remain together while surgery is completed. If I'm completely under general anesthetic for cesarean birth, I'd like my husband and doula to be present and for my husband to be the one to hold our baby first and throughout my procedure. So it's going to be very, very rare that those preferences as stated are going to be granted. When mothers are under general in the OR, they don't let anybody in. Typically. Now, do I think that's good practice? No. I'm not impressed with that. I think the family should stay together even when things are scary and stressful. But I think the history of this procedure is such that they want to really reduce any wild card effect. At certain hospitals, they only allow one care provider in the room with a mother during a C-section when there's not general anesthesia. So if there's an epidural or a spinal, then you can have one care provider with you during the course of that. And so that's a conversation that you would also have with your partner and doula about, you know, who's prepared to be in the OR. And what will their focus be? The reason I always think it would be nice if both doula and partner can be in the room is that, of course, in most families, the desire is to have a family member who can be in physical and emotional and social contact with the baby, as soon as possible, right? And so in the OR, once the baby is born, the baby and the cord clamped, they usually take the baby to the warmer and pediatricians are examining the baby. And so the partner can go to the warmer, greet the baby, say hello, talk to mom, who's not very far away, and tell her, oh, you know, they're doing well, and, you know, or whatever, right? So that there's a way of staying in voice contact during the procedure if possible. And then, you know, there is something we now refer to as family-centered C-section, where actually they do put the baby on the mom and they do lower the screen. And, you know, you just get to see more and participate in more. And that's just such a lovely thing. And unfortunately, it's not standard operating procedure. You do have to find the team that's willing to do your C-section birth that way.
See, I just look at movies and I think that's always what happens. Mom's awake. She's kind of out of it, all dragged up. And then baby comes out and they lay her on her chest and she says, oh, my baby. And then, of course, the actor baby is like a 3-month-old.
Yeah.
But
who looks lovingly into the mother's eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. What determines if someone is put under general anesthesia or not?
Well,
is that emergency versus planned?
Yeah, kind of typically thing? An emergency C-section is going to be one that results from a baby going into deep distress. Mm-hmm. And that means that they're not probably getting enough oxygen for some reason. Mm-hmm. We typically imagine that that's a cord problem. And
like wrapped around their neck or something.
Wrapped around their neck or pinch, you know, it's prolapsed and it's pinching between the baby's bones and the mother's pelvis or something of that nature. We can't always determine it in advance, but we're imagining that. Or there just isn't enough placental oxygen diffusion to keep that baby afloat.
I've had friends who said, and they had their baby maybe 35 years ago now, but she said that she had her baby born with the cord around his neck. Person is fine now. The baby was fine.
Oh,
but they came out, but they were blue.
Yeah.
You know, so they definitely had oxygen issues.
Yeah. So the blue thing could have to do with the cord and probably did, but not always. You know, it's interesting that babies can be born with tight cords around their neck and recover very quickly. And it wasn't necessarily an issue during the birth, believe it or not. And then, of course, it can be a real problem. It can, if the cord is short or if there's many loops around the baby and therefore the cord doesn't have the runout room to make it all the way out the pelvis, then the baby might not even emerge.
Oh, gosh.
Right?
Yeah.
So at some point, that's going to show up as this baby's not coming out.
Yikes.
And maybe isn't going to. And maybe now they're not having a good time, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, a mom who's struggling to push a baby out and the baby just isn't descending no matter what is tried is plausibly going to also have a C-section, even if the baby isn't in distress, right? If the assessment is, oh, well, the baby's still way high in the pelvis, hasn't descended at all. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they're growing a capit, but there's no bones coming down. Mm. Then that may be a mother's pelvis that's narrow. Right now, in the old days, this was an excuse for a lot of unnecessary C-sections. They could just say, you know, after you push 3 times, oh, your baby can't get out. Or even your baby's never going to get out, so you might as well not go through birth. So we're very, you know, we have this legacy of a past of altogether unnecessary C-sections and a high rate of C-sections being performed. But that has really, at least I would say in the Bay Area, for the most part, been absolutely corrected. We still have C-sections in cases where we think the labor might have been managed better and we therefore might have had no need for the C-section, but then are C-sections being utilized in all situations where they are necessary? So that's still a question, right? And recently heard a TED talk about are we doing too many unnecessary C-sections and not enough necessary ones, and could we improve our maternal child health outcomes for labor and birth if we were doing more appropriate C-sections and fewer unnecessary ones? So this is an interesting question, and it's out in the world, and I think, you know, anyone who's going to be having a baby owes it to themselves and their child to really understand what are the implications for a C-section, you know, planned or unplanned? You know, many, many people to this day still say they would like to have an elective C-section. They're fearful of giving birth, or they imagine it's going to change their body in some way that they prefer not to. And they're asking for C-sections. And that is not good public health. That is not good individual health. So we know that labor and birth are good for the body, good for the mother, good for the baby.
Right. So, yeah, I've heard of a mentality of wanting to schedule the cesarean so you know what day it is. And
yeah,
I know. You can see the positive aspects. If your C-section is necessary, then, you know, you can definitely focus on the positives there with the ability to plan and all of that stuff. But that in and of itself is sometimes used as a reason for one.
Yeah.
Just busy schedules or planning time off or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a major surgery, right?
So it's a major surgery.
Cutting through the skin of the belly. What else?
Yeah. Then the peritoneum, which is that fascia layer that between or below the fat layer, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of holds everything inside the gut. And that's after the muscle layer. So we've got skin, fat, muscle, peritoneum, uterus.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And all of that has
and
to
the work. Uterus is multi-layers of muscle, interwoven muscle. So there's something like 5 to 7 layers that are going to be, you know, gone through, and then the baby emerges, and then all of that gets repaired. So it's quick to get in there,
mm-hmm.
right? The prep for the C-section doesn't typically take very long, but then each of those layers has to be repaired.
Yeah.
With the possible exception of the fat. You know, I don't think they have to stitch that together, but every other layer has to be closed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that can take half an hour. So a 45-minute to 1 hour surgery is mostly repair.
Mm-hmm.
And what we know is that that humans are prone to adhesions, which is scar tissue that grows out into the body and tends to adhere to other tissue. And that's the legacy of abdominal surgery. That's not well performed, or that's well performed, but that requires such big incisions that there's going to be a lot of scar tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so much of abdominal surgery these days is done laparoscopically. So the actual incisions are tiny, comparatively. But if you're having a C-section, you have to have an incision that's broad enough to get the baby out of the body. Right.
So that's what. 5, 10
it's probably, no, it's not more than 5. It's probably, it's probably 7 centimeters maybe across,
mm-hmm.
Maybe 10.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking that it has to kind of grow circularly, right? So it's a straight incision that's going to kind of expand into a circle as the baby's removed. So probably 5 centimeters is about all that it takes, but I actually don't know. I've never measured it. It's a good question.
Maybe different for different people and baby sizes.
Sure.
Yeah. So we've talked about cesarean for about a little over 10 minutes.
Yeah. And let me just end
with... We can
keep
going, but just want to
I'll just end with that. The reason for avoiding C-section for the mother's health is the long-term effects of the possibility of adhesions, as well as, you know, musculoskeletal things.
Mm.
And just like we've talked about postpartum getting physical therapy for pelvic floor issues,
mm-hmm.
I would highly recommend that anybody who's had major surgery sign themselves up for physical therapy after the fact, because the retraining of the musculoskeletal by a skillful professional is really good. And obstetricians this isn't what they do. They'll refer you to a specialist to help you with this. But I would say in terms of your healing and recovery,
mm-hmm.
everyone who's given birth, no matter how they've done so, if they can have access to some physical therapy for assessment and therapy, that would probably be good for everybody.
Yeah, so we have a great episode, number 22, with Susie Haitley,
mm-hmm.
Who is a Canadian physical fitness guru, and she, you know, she herself has had twins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think her sister had twins too. It's mm-hmm. kind of amazing in their family, and they, anyway, so they have firsthand experience of that recovery process, and she's helped many, many pregnant women prepare and recover from pregnancy and childbirth. So listen to that episode too, if you're kind of wondering what that like recovery physical aspect might be like. And, you know, we don't want to turn this into the C-section episode, but
right.
I have to mention that, you know, some of the considerations around opting for a C-section, if it is an option for you, and this is something that I don't think is talked about that much, is sort of more of an emotional aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And it's come up in other episodes, I want to say with Shanti Smith.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely came up, which is episode 26.
Mm-hmm. Assisting birth.
Yeah, and I think Kimberly Johnson talked about it too a little bit. And we've had two episodes with Kimberly. She's great. The kind of themes around that are, if you have a vaginal birth, there's a different kind of connection that your body makes. And it's a sort of a subconscious connection than if there's a C-section birth. And that sometimes women who have a C-section, their bodies are waiting to give birth still, even though their babies have been born. And I know that's a funny concept, and this won't be true for everyone, but it's something to think about, that the body is expecting something, and our bodies are highly intelligent organisms that don't necessarily tell us what they're doing. You know, our heart beats without us telling it to do that. So there's systems and processes going on inside of ourselves that we don't consciously control. And Shanti has mentioned working with mothers who need to sort of have the somatic experience or the mind experience of having the baby vaginally so that their bodies can just relax and feel that they've done that.
Yeah. Just kind of completed.
Right.
Circuit.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 So anyway, something to think about.
It's not, I think it's great.
Yeah.
Thanks for reminding us of that, Sarah. That's really brilliant. Yeah. There are many levels at which we simultaneously are doing our healing work and our recovery work. So however we give birth.
Yep.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah. So the next and last segment of the preferences plan is talking about the immediate postpartum. So as the baby actually has emerged and in the next couple of minutes and hours. So I'll read the what's written in this preferences plan, and then we'll discuss it a little further each point. So the first point on this plan is, upon moment of birth, the mother and partner would like undisturbed, quiet time to bond with the baby and to establish breastfeeding as soon as the baby is ready, which I think I would love every preferences plan to state this unequivocally. And I would love it if that's what I saw happening in the hospital setting. Because it's very important. There's something, lactation consultants now get to study sort of the normal physiological process of the immediate postpartum. And one of the things they note again and again is that the natural process of emerging, finding the mother's contact, you know, the baby finding contact with the mother, and then on its own, in its own time, in its own particular way, doing what we like to call the breast crawl, right? Where the baby actually kind of moves themselves, mostly with their heads and a little bit with those kicky legs that you've been feeling on the inside. And they basically will move along the mother's body and find a breast all by themselves, unassisted, latch themselves on, and have a good feed. Now, it's extremely rare when that's what gets experienced for the baby and the parents. And there is some amount of theorizing around the fact that so much of the first couple of weeks of breastfeeding is so problematic for so many moms and babies that this has to do with trauma experienced in those immediate postpartum moments. So the trauma may be the baby's trauma, it may be the mother's trauma, or maybe the dyad's trauma, or, you know, that can include the partner, of course. And so at a recent doula meeting, we were discussing breastfeeding, And a lactation consultant who is not a birth doula said, this is how it's supposed to go. And all of us who go to births were shaking our heads going, that never, that's not what we see happening at all. That's not what we see happening. What we see happening is a baby emerges, is put on the mother's belly. One or two nurses moves in on that baby and starts rubbing the baby, right? To warm it up, to get the amniotic fluid off so that the baby doesn't cool down, to stimulate the baby to cry if they haven't cried yet. So they're all this rationale around sort of pouncing on the baby with a lot of activity. I've seen residents flick the baby's heels, which is extremely overstimulating for a newborn. And it's all to make that baby cry so that we know that baby can breathe.
So you used air quotes when you said warm the baby. I was just going to mention.
Yeah. Well, the fear being that the baby will be cold. But, you know, a mother who's just been pushing a baby out, I'm sure you remember, Sarah, is probably easily 98.6, if not a little warmer as a result of the physical activity of pushing their baby out. Mm-hmm. So a baby who lands on a mom is going to immediately be back in an environment of 98.6.
Oh, yeah. They might be a little bit wet, but having that, the little person on the chest is so important emotionally, I think, for the mother, if that's possible, with all the physical stuff going on. But just having that moment, and then mom's body helps keep the baby's body warm, and you can put a little blanket.
Usually you can put a blanket over the top of both of them that's going to insulate, right? And will also absorb fluid so that if it becomes damp, you can replace it with another warm receiving blanket. Those are available.
Yeah.
So while I understand I do honestly understand and honor why nurses are doing what they do, but I also understand that it's part of a system that's very fearful does not see the deeper implications for how we're treating mom and baby in those moments. So, this was kind of an aha moment for the lactation consultant who's never been to a birth. Like, oh, and then they're diving in and rubbing the mother's tummy. If she doesn't have an epidural, she's going to really feel that, and it's going to be very distractingly painful.
We talk about that in this preferences document.
Yeah, they're pulling on the cord. There are all kinds of activities to make the placenta deliver rather than allow the placenta to deliver. So all of this is happening simultaneous to the baby being born and can be quite traumatic. I mean, I've had moms say, I can't hold the baby. I just can't hold the baby while all this is going on.
Yeah. So by stating clearly ahead of time, hey, look, we want some quiet time. I want to hold the baby, assuming that's safe, which hopefully it is.
Yeah.
Then they have that time to kind of relax and have that moment. So it's really painful to have your belly rubbed too.
It is. Yeah. It's very painful and distracting. And the fact is that from my perspective and based on my training, which I know is shared by probably now a minority of obstetricians, but I know that there are obstetricians who were trained by obstetricians who knew better than to manipulate the uterus and the placenta, and that allowing the mother, you know, an average of 20 to 30 minutes for her uterus to gather itself, right? It's had, you know, a 7-pound baby taking up the space, and now it's kind of a floppy bag, and it's going to take time for the oxytocin to build up and squeeze that bag down into a size and with enough pressure to naturally peel that uterus off the face of that muscle mass. This is normal. This
peel
is
natural. The placenta.
Yes, exactly. The placenta is going to peel away from the face of the uterus and get pushed out by the uterus. But there is a time frame around that. And so allowing for that time frame. So when you have your preferences document, be specific. We want to allow at least up to 30 minutes for the uterus to do its own best job of releasing the placenta.
And does nursing help?
Absolutely. That's, again, a natural course of things. So if you're messing with a mom in such a way that she feels she can't even hold her baby, you are thwarting the best way to get the uterus to gather itself and push that placenta out.
What's happening?
Which is letting that baby nuzzle that nipple, mess around. You know, there's a lot of nipple stimulation when a little kid's bobbing their head all over your chest. Not only that, but think of this, like as they're kicking their way up, they're kicking those little feet and getting traction in your belly. They themselves are massaging and stimulating the top of your uterus.
But in a way that feels like the most glorious sensation in the world versus someone who's maybe
diving
invading
with
personal
fist.
Space.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But so if a baby latches on and there's something that happens, there's a reaction in the uterus, and that's fascinating. That's sort of nature doing its work.
Right. In an integrated fashion, in a timely fashion.
Mm. Hi, listeners. I have some exciting news to share with you today. We've partnered with Every Mother, your go-to destination for evidence-based exercise therapy regimens. Whether you're dealing with diastasis recti, preparing for birth, or navigating postpartum recovery, Every Mother has your back. With personalized daily routines tailored to your core and pelvic floor needs, they're here to support you every step of the way. Say hello to a stronger, healthier you with Every Mother. Visit their website today and use code 4thTrimester10 for 10% off your personalized regimen. That's fourth spelled out, F-O-U-R-T-H, trimester10 for 10% off, because every mother deserves the very best.
So it all fits together, doesn't it?
It
all fits together beautifully. And, you know, frankly, even if a mom has an epidural, you know, it's not physiologically more correct for them to do that just because she can't feel it. And it's my experience that obstetricians are walking in and out of the birth room without actually noting whether or not a mom has an epidural.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm to the point in my career where I think that there should be a sign on the door that says no epidural in big red letters, so that when somebody walks in the room, they don't treat that body that's in front of them as if it can't feel anything.
Yeah.
Because frankly, even if it can't, the body knows.
Yeah.
It will be experiencing what's happening.
Yeah.
Right? So there's that. But especially because many of my clients don't have epidurals. So when that resident walks in the room and assumes that that mom can't feel anything, and without asking, you know, puts a hand into their belly and causes them deep pain that they cry out about, and then turns to them and says, I'm sorry, I just have to do this. I mean, it's a form of torture. Like, it's just not right. I have a real problem with this, Sarah. I can see it in my face right now.
Yeah, no.
I have a serious problem with how this is happening.
I mean, we wouldn't let someone on the street do that. I mean, it's not like doctors or people on the street. Doctors are like respected and wonderful people. But it's just
I think it's a consciousness problem.
Yeah.
Like, the consciousness around this is not well developed in most obstetricians, sadly.
Mm-hmm.
And because the epidural rate is 85%, it's a pretty good assumption when they walk into the room that somebody in there is going to have an epidural. Unfortunately, it's not right. It's not correct. Right.
To assume
that they have an epidural, but also to behave in that way.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, there are instances where massaging the uterus is going to be appropriate and necessary, and the mother is going to feel it. So let's help her cope.
Sort of.
That's what I'm not seeing.
Right.
Right. If I see, you know, if my clients are having baby time together, I sit back and allow them that space. And I pick up my knitting and I listen. Now, if a doctor steps in and does something like that, I don't have time to step in and say, okay, Sarah, there's a little bit of difficulty here that we're going to have to address, and it's not going to be easy, and I want to help you through it. So I'm going to make eye contact with you, and I'm going to breathe with you while we're delivering your placenta. I'm sorry that this is going to be painful, but we're going to get through it together. So I can do that work as a doula, but not if nobody cares, right? Of course, my clients would have liked to have that, right? There's no reason why an obstetrician can't learn the same skills and say, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to do this procedure. It's not going to be comfortable. Look in my eyes and I will help you through it while they do this thing with their hands. That's by feel, right? They don't need their eyes on the mom's belly button to do this procedure, I promise you. I've done it myself many times successfully, right? So, you know, this is another point where what I love about this podcast is hopefully it's another little needle in the voodoo doll of culture change. I don't know. I'm hoping. But, you know, it means raising the consciousness of birth practitioners.
I think it's called bedside manner in some cases.
We call it bedside manner. We do in this country.
So let's speak to...
And we have to learn manners, don't we? So to be fair, if no one's ever approached this person and said, it's important that you proceed in this emotional, social fashion while you're doing this procedure on a live human being, right? They don't know. And that's not fair to them either. So what's next?
Well, I wanted to just highlight so that the stuff that we're talking about rubbing the belly to help give birth to the placenta, that's what's referred to as active management in the document. So because I had that question when I first heard that term. I was like, active management of the placenta? That's about like aiding the placenta delivery outside of what's... like the body would do on its own.
Right. And let me just correct what I have in the past thought was active management, which was all that belly rubbing and pulling on the cord and things of that nature. And it turns out that active management is actually limited to only giving a shot of Pitocin.
Oh.
All that other stuff, that's not included in medical active management.
Oh. Okay. Oh, so that's an official medical term.
But people do it all the time as part of quote unquote active management. So
maybe it needs to be added here into the document. So anyone who's customizing it can say, please let me know if you're going to rub my belly or pull on the cord. I would prefer those not to happen.
Yes.
But if you are going to do something, then please tell me before you do so I may prepare my body.
Yes.
Or my head, even if it's 10 seconds or something.
Yes, exactly right.
Yeah.
And on this document, it says, as a matter of fact, please only give the routine, otherwise routine, Pitocin shot if there is hemorrhaging. Okay. So now you may have had Pitocin during the course of your labor for some reason, and they're going to just open the Pitocin at the end of your labor and let it run in by way of getting your uterus to clamp down nice and tight. Now that's what your body would do. Mm-hmm. It would send out a flood of Pitocin, or oxytocin, I should say. The baby would breastfeed. That would get more going.
Yeah.
And then your placenta would deliver. So there's nothing particularly incorrect about that extra Pitocin at the end of labor. The active management protocol was developed based on studies that showed that malnourished women were extremely prone to hemorrhage at the end of labor. Prone to hemorrhage. Kinds of hemorrhage that could really be health and or life threatening. Okay. And so this idea that, okay, well, we will just prophylactically give these women a shot of Pitocin in order to prevent this hemorrhage. Well, of course, as with so many things in terms of public health, particularly for women, it was determined that, gosh, well, why don't we just give it to everybody? So it doesn't matter if at the end of your pregnancy, you're not anemic, you're well-nourished, you're physically fit, etc., right? Mm-hmm. You're going to get that shot of Pitocin. So specifically saying, I made it to the end of my pregnancy in good health, and I would like to let my body, you know, do this last thing it does by way of ending my pregnancy without the Pitocin, unless there is actual evidence of hemorrhaging, is fair.
Yeah.
It's not, you're not asking for anything that isn't fair.
Yep.
And unfortunately, we then also have to add in this other thing that is ubiquitous, which is this manipulation of the uterus and the placenta. Please, please refrain from doing any of that unless I am hemorrhaging.
Yeah. Right? Okay.
So,
all right. So just time check. We're about 40 minutes. So we're going to race through the rest.
We're going to race through the rest because all of these things are interrelated and lovely. Please save the placenta for us to take home for encapsulation. We have provided a Tupperware container, preferably glass with a plastic lid, for catching the placenta when it's delivered. Refrain from routinely suctioning the baby either in the nose or mouth. That's to help a baby not become overstimulated in the part of the body that needs to latch on to a nipple. don't rub the baby vigorously to stimulate that unless the baby is in actual distress or isn't breathing and needs to be stimulated. Allow the cord to pulse out before clamping and ask the partner if they'd like to cut the cord.
The pulsing out is what? Allowing the baby to get that last nice juicy blood from the placenta.
Correct. And by the way, many babies, you know, a placenta could keep pumping oxygenated blood into a baby for sometimes 10, 20 minutes after the baby has been delivered. If that baby isn't breathing on their own with their lungs yet, that could be critical. But what we do in our culture is when we see a baby in distress, we clamp that, cut that, and then take them and stimulate the hell out of them, right? So there's real questions about, is that appropriate or not, right? Like, can we assess whether this baby's doing fine and whether they're getting oxygenation first before treating it like a dire emergency? So that's just a little...
Yeah. It doesn't have to be one or the other. Like, if, you know, just don't clamp it, but if you want to help the baby in some way, do it, you know, it doesn't hurt to have that cord going
intact. Right.
Yeah.
And even once it stops pulsing, there's no reason it has to be immediately clamped and cut. Right. Like they could just hang out like that. The placenta could get delivered and you could still hang out like that. Right. So, there's no immediate need to, you know, separate a baby from its placenta.
Yeah. And I mean,
so take your time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, again, if it doesn't hurt and there's a potential benefit, even if it's not proven or whatever, then, you know, if it's not hurting anything, you might as well give it a shot for the first, like, what, 10 minutes or something.
Sure.
Allow it to pulse out, or maybe just for all the time that the baby's on your chest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
So the next item is delay all routine tests and vaccinations for the first 2 hours. In California, those routine procedures are erythromycin ointment in the eyes, hepatitis vaccine, and vitamin K shot. And this plan asks that they be performed in the room with one of the parents holding the baby. It says the only exception is the vitamin K shot, which can be administered within the first 2 hours, so long as one of us is holding the baby. So vitamin K is a clotting factor that we make in our stomachs, and it takes about, and we need a microbiome to produce it, and it takes about 7 days before our bodies actually are absorbing vitamin K. And it's a blood clotting factor. So the reason why vitamin K is given as a shot routinely in America is to provide the baby with a clotting factor to help avoid stroke, believe it or not, like brain hemorrhage. Yeah. So I think in the case of a baby who's had a particularly traumatic labor and birth, maybe if there were forceps or vacuum.
Anything that could break a blood vessel in the head.
Mm-hmm. I think I would actually want them given that vitamin K shot as fast as possible, which they don't do. But in any case, like I think most of the time it's not necessary, but if it were to be, then we do have this prophylaxis we can use. Some people want to use oral drops, but unfortunately the problem with that is that babies actually do vomit quite a bit. You know, if they have a lot of mucus in their stomach, they may vomit it out. And so there's no guarantee that that oral dose is going to actually make it and do its job in a timely fashion. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean it's not okay to try it. And I think that, I sort of, my kids didn't get vitamin K. They were born at home. I didn't want it. They don't seem to have had strokes, but
it's probably fair to say they didn't.
pretty fair. Yeah. So we do not want our baby bathed. Do not wipe our baby. Leave the vernix and amniotic fluid on it. Keep us warm with blankets. That's a reiteration. Mother will breastfeed. Mom and partner are going to stay close to baby as much as possible during the hospital stay. No pacifier or bottle for the baby. No fingers in the baby's mouth. Now that fingers in the baby's mouth is particularly important to discuss because one of the things that pediatricians are looking for when they do the full body examination of your baby is whether or not your baby's palate is closed. So they're actually feeling for a closed palate. Now,
what's a closed palate?
Meaning, when we're fetuses, our bodies are being created sort of like this, two sides coming together in the middle. Mm-hmm. And so when we see spinal cord defect, we see it as showing up as holes at one end or the other of the spinal cord, and the associated organs and structures in the middle can sometimes have holes in them. Mm-hmm. That's a kind of a gross way of putting it. And one of the places where that can happen is in the palate. The palate doesn't close completely over the sinuses. Now there may be skin there, but the bones aren't together.
So there's a hole.
So there can be a hole on the upper palate, your baby's upper jaw.
The roof of their mouth.
Thank you. That's the term. The roof of the baby's mouth, if it's not patent, can signal an issue. And that's why pediatricians stick a finger in and feel around your baby's mouth. Now, of course, it's my opinion that for most babies who don't have this problem, that's overstimulation at a critical time when babies are learning to breastfeed. And I would like it if no babies have to undergo that in the first week. But of course, on the other hand, I would certainly want to know if my baby has a central nervous system issue as soon as possible.
Oh, yeah.
So we are weighing those two things. And I think it's fair to ask, say, the pediatrician who comes in to examine your baby, when you do the oral exam, could you be just as delicate as you possibly can while doing that? And could you please do that right here? Right? I'm concerned that my baby have the least amount of oral stimulation that is not related to breastfeeding.
Yeah. When I read that first time, I thought maybe it was just about people like kind of playing with the baby or pacifying the baby.
Right. And it is about that. It's very common for nurses to do it themselves while messing around with the baby, or to tell a partner, here, if they're crying like that, just stick your finger in and they'll be quiet. Well, why don't we examine why they're crying and see if there's something we can actually do about the crying? Are they hungry? Are we subjecting them to a procedure like a diaper change? I mean, they do not love to be put on their backs. If for them it feels like an attack to have a diaper change, especially if they're hungry. Mm-hmm. If they've awakened, they are in readiness for feeding, they're not expecting a diaper change. They will become apoplectic, just really angry and upset, which is going to mean that when mom finally gets them to the breast, they're going to be very tired and very upset. They're not necessarily going to be any longer in good readiness for breastfeeding. So one of the first things I tell my clients about their hospital stay is, unlike what you're going to be told, don't wake your baby to breastfeed and don't start with the diaper change. Have your baby close, and when they stir, have the breast ready for them in proximity.
Maybe they just want to wake up, latch on, and kind of nod off back to sleep.
They might.
Right.
And that's good for them. And it's good for mom, right? They've latched on. That's a little bit of uterine stimulation. All of these things are good for moms and babies. So, you know, swaddling your baby up with three blankets and a hat and sticking them in a bassinet across the room from you isn't necessarily going to be the thing that actually promotes a healthy breastfeeding relationship. But it's standard operating procedure in the hospital, and they will frighten you about whether or not to hold your baby in bed with you. Just saying.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being encouraged to have a lot of skin-to-skin contact, which I thought was wonderful.
It is wonderful. Yeah.
You know.
They're worried that if you fall asleep with a baby in your bed, bad things could happen. But if there are two of you, or three or four, somebody can always be holding the baby while it's asleep.
Yeah.
Right? Who's not sleeping?
Okay. We've gone through everything in the document.
Mm-hmm.
If you have questions, you can email either of us. Go on the about page on our website, fourthtrimesterpodcast.com. Email one or both of us. We'll be sure to answer your questions. We also had someone reach out recently through our Facebook page. So please join our Facebook page. If you didn't know it existed, we have one. Sign up and join and follow us. We share a lot of cool stuff all the time. So, as a final reminder, also sign up for our newsletter on fourthtrimesterpodcast.com and sponsor us.
Yes.
So thank you so much for listening. And
it would be so nice for Sarah and me if everybody who listened to an episode could pitch us a buck.
Yeah,
absolutely. That would be great.
We would appreciate
it. Think of the things we could do if we were meeting costs and having some little extra to, you know, go to interesting conferences and present for you guys, or who knows,
or produce more episodes more frequently. That's something else that we'd probably be able to do. So just a few incentives there. Thank you so much. And once again, thanks for listening. And we wish everyone a very happy and well-resourced pregnancy and postpartum.
Yes. Yay. Thanks, Sarah. As always, so lovely.
Likewise. Yeah. See you later, Esther.
Yeah, ciao.
You can subscribe to this podcast in order to hear more from us. Thank you for listening, everyone, and I hope you'll join us next time on the fourth trimester. The theme music on this podcast was created by Sean Trott. Hear more at soundcloud.com/Sean Trott. Special thanks to my true loves, my husband Ben, daughter Penelope, and baby girl Evelyn. Don't forget to share the fourth trimester podcast with any new and expecting parents. I'm Sarah Trott. Goodbye for now.
Hello again, bicycle man. I know you're doing all that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I'll sing a song for you. You got your wheels, you got your gears. You ride around town without any fear. You got your pedals, you got your brakes. You always wear your helmet for safety's sake. Hello again, bicycle man. I know you're doing the best that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I sing a song for you.